start with some introductory remarks while we wait for Chairman Cox to join. Welcome to the 7th Annual Meeting of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on June 6th, which happens to be the Commission's 72nd birthday. I'm John Ramsey, the Society's President for the 06-07 year. It's my pleasure to welcome those present here at the Commission's headquarters as well as those listening to our broadcast. Over the last year, we've been able to substantially enhance the material that's available in our virtual museum, and we've seen a phenomenal growth in the number of visits to the museum. We also have been able to continue to sponsor a number of quality programs, like the one we're going to hear today, that help to give historical context to the issues that confront the capital markets. That requires a lot of help, of course, not just volunteer effort, but also monetary contributions from a wide circle of individuals and organizations. On behalf of my fellow trustees, I want to give a heartfelt thanks to those who have contributed. As I'm sure you know, notwithstanding our name, we are completely independent of the SEC itself, we get no federal funds, and we're entirely dependent on your generosity to continue our work. Today's program is titled, Who's Counting? The Critical Role of Financial Reporting in the Capital Markets. I'd like to thank Bob Kippers, my predecessor as president for the past 2 years, and this year's chairman for leading the development of this program. More than that, Bob, thanks from everyone connected to the Society for your leadership during that period of time. To say that you're a hard act to follow doesn't really begin to do it justice. I'd also like to recognize the other important contributors to today's program, the members of our Office of the Chief Accountant Committee, and that includes Chairs Linda Griggs and Gary Previtz, along with Jack Albert, James Barge, Scott Bayless, Bob Colson, and Terry Iannacone. I also would be remiss if I did not recognize Carla Rosati, our Executive Director. Carla doesn't ask for a whole lot of credit, but she certainly deserves a lot. The Society would not have achieved anything like its current success without her tireless effort and devotion. So those are the preliminaries. I think in a few moments we'll be joined by Chairman Cox, and he will make some introductory remarks as well, and then we will go directly into the program. So if you'll bear with us a few moments more, we will get underway.
Good afternoon. In the intervening time here, I thought what I'd do is introduce our panel for the discussion. When the chairman arrives, we will hear his remarks, and then we can move into our topic of we've called our program, Who's Counting? The Role of Financial Reporting in the Capital Markets. I'm Bob Kippers. I'm the 2006-07 chairman of the Society and deputy CEO of Deloitte & Touche LLP. I'm really honored today that we've put together a great program with great guest speakers, and we're going to discuss some issues that I think are very relevant today, but also have their roots in our history, and I think will help define where we go in the future. Let me introduce our panel, and I'll start on my right, my immediate right, Pat McConnell. Pat's known to many of us as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns & Company, has been following the issues and reporting on the issues of financial reporting, financial statements, accountants, and accounting for some years, and in fact, I consider Pat to be sort of the pioneer in really specializing in this arena, and we've all enjoyed her work and her insights for many years, and now we get to enjoy it for the next hour as well. On my far right is Don Nicolaisen, who may be recognized by some. I apparently had little trouble getting into the building today, and we really appreciate his return to his former agency, where, of course, he served most recently as its chief accountant, and prior to that, many years in the practice of public accounting, both in client roles as well as national office for many years at PricewaterhouseCoopers. On my immediate left is former commissioner of the SEC that many of us know. Alana and I actually started the same month, June of 1984, but since then has gone on to further great things, not the least of which is her service today on a number of very important and prominent audit committees. And even though she has the commissioner perspective to bring, we're going to be asking her, from sitting in that audit committee chair, how does she view these issues, and how does that contribute to our debate? And on my far left, Larry Salva, Senior Vice President, Chief Accounting Officer and Controller of the Comcast Corporation. Larry is also an alum of the SEC, having served his fellowship here a long time ago. So we overlapped for part of our time. Larry is very active in the financial reporting community, of course, as a preparer, an issuer, you might call him, if you're an SEC person, and extremely active, importantly, in FEI and its Committee on Corporate Reporting. That's a very important group, and Larry plays a leadership role there. So between preparer, audit committee, regulator, analyst, and I'll do my best to say something on behalf of my profession, we'll hopefully cover the issues. With that, let me turn it back to John.
Thank you. I thanked a lot of other people earlier. Finally, I want to give sincere thanks to Chairman Chris Cox for his support of the Society. Thanks, first of all, for allowing us to use this wonderful space, and thanks especially for demonstrating your support by being here with us in person. I know you've agreed to share a few remarks on behalf of the Commission, so we'll turn to that now. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Chairman Christopher Cox.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to see Bob Kippers chairing this today because Bob and I have a lot in common. His grandparents lived across the street from me when I was growing up, and Bob himself grew up just a few blocks away, so we're trying to keep this all in the family. I want formally to welcome everyone to the 7th annual meeting of the SEC Historical Society. Our theme today promises to be not only interesting but comprehensive. Our modest topic is nothing less than the critical role of accounting and financial reporting in the capital market system. So how much time do you have today? We've got a lot to cover. I want to thank all of you for attending, especially the former chief accountants who've so generously given of their time to be here. I also want to thank former Commissioner Alana Peters for taking part in today's panel. A special welcome is also in order for John Ramsey, Managing Director and Deputy General Counsel at Citigroup Capital Markets, who is, as you all know, the new President of the Board of Trustees of the SEC Historical Society. So thank you very much, John. In fact, before we start, I want to take time to single out the Historical Society and praise and congratulate the institution for the work that it does. All of us here in this building and in our offices across the country have our feet firmly planted in the present as we look forward to the future. But our past is also very important to the people who labor in this agency. It makes us proud to know what the Securities and Exchange Commission has accomplished over so many years in behalf of America's investors. And the repository of that pride is the SEC Historical Society. The Society is independent from the object of its research and scholarship. Contrary to what many people think, it does not receive any funding from the SEC. We can, however, as individuals, support it, and I invite you all to do so, and anyone who's listening to these proceedings. And I should add that they're nice enough to give us staff discounts. Whether you decide to take up this offer or not, you should at least visit their magnificent website, www.sechistorical.org. This is a museum where you can easily take the kids because it's virtual. You don't even have to get dressed to go to this museum. The Society is once again demonstrating how important it is to our ongoing mission by hosting this event today. Accountants of old may have thought that mentioning their occupation at a cocktail party wasn't the best way to strike up a conversation. But these days, accounting is definitely a hot topic. It's getting a lot of attention for a very simple reason. How we account for our assets provides the underpinning for shareholder valuation. And more than ever before, most Americans are now concerned about this because that's the repository of their life savings and their future. That's why it's so important to arrive at the right standards, ones that truly reflect reality in each industry. Capital formation in our country depends upon it. If, as Marshall McLuhan said in another context, the medium is the message, then that medium is going to have to get a whole lot less complex. Over the past 50 years, generally accepted accounting principles have developed to include over 2,000 separate pronouncements issued in various forms by numerous bodies. The complexity inherent in our financial reporting system has resulted from the very best of intentions. It's born of the desire to protect investors. But in recent years, that complexity has resulted in problems for the financial reporting community and for the consumers of financial reports. Unnecessary complexity has added to the costs in financial reporting, and that in turn may have contributed to numerous restatements. It's also been used to hide things rather than to disclose things to investors. Not surprisingly, users of financial statements, including investors, creditors, regulators like ourselves, and policymakers, including the Congress, are demanding more balanced, comparable, and understandable financial reporting. And preparers and auditors are looking for standards that are easier to understand and comply with. As a result, the Securities and Exchange Commission has been encouraging a major national effort to remove unnecessary complexity from the financial reporting system. As we all here know, we're taking steps toward simplification of this very system. The FASB is working to codify all of the existing literature to establish a single source for all GAAP material. It is also, with our support, reassessing specific standards in major areas where rules are currently failing to provide transparent information, such as accounting for leases, accounting for pensions and other post-employment benefits, consolidation policies, and accounting for financial instruments. And the FASB is working toward a more principles-based approach to accounting. Reducing complexity goes beyond the work of the FASB, however. The complexity that's crept into our system is the cumulative product of pressure from many different market constituencies. So a concerted and coordinated action plan by the SEC, the FASB, the PCAOB, as well as market participants, is what's called for. It's essential to the successful removal of the complexities in our financial reporting structure. That effort's going to be a long one, but it's worth making it in order to ensure that our capital markets remain strong and vibrant. I'm sure that this will be one of several topics that you're going to cover today because it's so central to financial reporting. This promises to be an excellent session. So now I'd like to turn it over to my neighbor, Bob Kipper.
Chairman Cox, thank you very, very much for those kind words. You know, the Society is a volunteer leadership organization, and to be part of something is great, but to have support of the chairman, the commissioners, division directors, and the staff makes it all that much more fun. Thank you very much. Before we begin our discussion, I need to state that the opinions expressed today are solely those of the panelists and are definitely not representative of the views of the Society itself. I also want to point out that our panelists cannot give legal or investment advice, or if they choose to do so, I would recommend you not listen to it. With those things out of the way, let me explain how we're going to work this afternoon. I would like to take the next hour or so and turn to our experts with a series of issues that I think dovetail very nicely into some of the things that Chairman Cox has mentioned in his remarks. And I think it's important to acknowledge before we begin that financial statements and the related disclosures that we're all familiar working with, whether we're preparing, auditing, overseeing, analyzing, or regulating, are really the core of the Commission's full disclosure system, and they've served investors very, very well over many decades. But as with all things, they have clearly evolved. And the emergence of certain trends in the United States with respect to financial statements, I think, are worthy of some exploration. About 20-some years ago, I was part of a group working with FEI looking at annual reports. In other words, the end product of what goes to meet the requirements of the proxy rules. And we noticed that disclosures, what I call the F pages, had grown from, 15 to 18 to 20 to now to 40, 60, 70. It's a great deal of information for investors to absorb. At the same time, it's a product of all the improvements and requirements people have found a need for. But it causes you to stop and think, where have we gone and where should we be going? Let me start with one topic that I think is generally known to those who follow financial reporting, and that's the increasing use of fair value in measurement of financial statement components. And it's not just the initial use of fair value in recording for the first time a transaction, an asset, an obligation, and so forth, but then the marking to market or the creation of differences from the initial recorded amount and the fact that fair value is now very much part of the financial reporting fabric. We also have some things that are recorded as historical cost and remain there, either being depreciated or tested for impairment, as the case may be. But what we end up with is what some might call a mixed attribute model. We've got some fair values. We've got some historical costs. When I was auditing in the mid-70s, I always liked historical costs because I could get a canceled check, and I could check my little tick mark and say I've audited that that asset. But the world has changed a great deal. Here's my question for the panel on this initial point, and it's fairly simplistic, but I think it's one that we'll have time to explore in some depth. And I'll pose this to Pat McConnell as our first responder, and then I'm sure our fellow panelists will have more. Is the increasing use of fair value good for investors? And the quality of information they receive in the audited financial statements, is the trend toward fair value the right way to go, Pat?
Well, from my perspective, fair values are not only good for investors, they're absolutely necessary to make rational and appropriate asset allocation decisions. That being said, the move to fair value is not universally welcome. It's more like a trip to the dentist. I think, investors need it, but just like a trip to the dentist, they don't enjoy it. They don't enjoy the shift, the change in the metrics that they're looking at, the different way they have to use the information from the change in historical cost. But just like a trip to the dentist, I think they will sooner or later recognize that they have to go in the direction of fair values or they're going to lose their teeth when they make investment decisions. In the meantime, we've got this mixed attribute model that Bob alluded to, which is very difficult to use in valuation and asset allocation. And an organization that I'm a member of, the Chartered Financial Analyst Institute, recently issued a draft paper called the Business Reporting Model, which proposes a redo of the basic financial statements in this awkward period in the transition between historical cost and fair value. And that presents sort of a matrix approach that we think would be very useful to investors to help them identify which bits are driven by historical costs and which are driven by fair values.
Okay. Larry, as a preparer, you'd have to struggle with this firsthand. Your views?
Yeah, I actually am interested in what Pat just mentioned, because I kind of think of that same thing as being useful, because we've created, or what has evolved in financial statements, I think, is such a hybrid of mixed attributes that it's almost become incomprehensible. You need to break down. I mean, even if I take a line item in my financial statements and try to understand how much of it is measured at fair value and remeasured, and it's actually mixed in the same line with other things that might be historical costs. So, or, for example, in my investment portfolio, it might all be at fair value, or for the most part at fair value, but some of it's running through comprehensive income while other is running through through net income. That I might almost suggest that maybe what we need to do is take a moratorium on introducing more fair value into the primary financial statements. I'm all for introducing more fair value into disclosures, into supplemental information, but to add more into the primary financials without stepping back and kind of dissecting the financials that exist already and try to get a better insight for investors into what's measured at fair value, what's remeasured, and then and also step back and take a look at what's the objective of financial statements, of the primary financial statements. And we get a better look at the conceptual framework and the primary objective of financial statements, the combined objective, if you will, of not only accounting for stewardship, management stewardship of the, because I, like you, Bob, was very comfortable with knowing what historical cost was, and I'd also like to know what return is on historical cost. And you lose some of that if you just kind of move totally to fair value. So, a moratorium, at least a slowdown in terms of introducing more fair value. Another good reason for slowing that down is that the accountants kind of have to retool their minds to stop thinking like accountants and start thinking more like valuation specialists. And that's a very different thought process that goes into fair value than historical cost accounting.
I agree with Larry's last comment, but if I go back about 30 seconds into his comments, I'm not sure that I would agree that the movement towards fair value accounting should be slowed down. I think that the concern as to how the value is going to be audited, the fair value management assigns to an asset can be audited, is a very valid one, but there's no doubt that the investor will benefit once we figure out the logistics of how to use the information. Initially, you can anticipate, and I'm speaking with as an audit committee member, initially I think you can anticipate that it'll take the profession some time to ramp up, because right now there's probably a dearth of valuation expertise in the at the audit level, but golly gee, they've been doing it for the past 10 years. Every time a new requirement is imposed, and I have complete faith that my former clientele, the accounting profession, will figure out how to audit these this information.
Bob, if I might just build on that a little bit as well. I too have faith in the audit and accounting profession to be able to do things. One of the things that I'm quite confident anyone can do is those things that are marked to market, look it up in the Wall Street Journal, is not terribly complicated. It's probably easier to find a current mark in the Wall Street Journal than it is for you to go back and find the real estate transaction that occurred in 1928, and the building that the company is currently in, and all the additions and changes that have happened to that since then. I think where all of us become more queasy and have some degree of reservations is when you get to mark-to-model and mark-to-model at the extreme, where there's really very little traded information and you're reliant upon people exercising good faith and good judgment in providing estimates of fair value. And I think that's the area where there does need to be more work. I don't think it's a matter of either or. I do think fair value has tremendous relevance.
historical cost also has some meaning because it's used in tax transactions, and certainly you're not going to lose that. You're going to have to maintain that for a very long period of time unless the tax codes change dramatically around the globe. So I would say I would look to the relevance of fair value and the need to be able to provide that to investors as being a much higher calling than the simplicity of looking something up in historical records.
Well, Don, what you're touching on, and it kind of opens the sort of the next follow-up question. The debate always tends to be relevance versus reliability. The old saw being that historical cost, if nothing else, is certainly reliable because it is rooted in an actual transaction, presumably a bargain transaction at market, whatever it is for that circumstance. And at the same time, over time, you end up losing relevance, one would argue. And so there's a little bit of tension between the relevance versus reliability. It would seem to me that in recent times, with the progress of fair value being embedded in the model, that relevance is winning, and that's not a bad thing. I wouldn't suggest that. But there is sort of two sides, and I think what each of us has maybe touched on but not really explored is, okay, the mixed attribute model is eventually just going to trend toward having a complete mark-to-market on all assets and liabilities, if you think of the balance sheet. And we get into some areas, and I'll touch on this and see if you have any thoughts or comments, where I would argue in the derivatives arena, for example, just the existence of what some might call the hedging exception has what's led to the complexity of those standards, those interpretations, has led to what one might argue are entire industries devoted to taking what I don't for a minute suggest is not a legitimate advantage of the way the standard is constructed, but that one exception has fostered a lot of complexity, a lot of confusion on the part of preparers and auditors. And I just wanted to know if we could go around one more time and get your take on relevance versus reliability, and also is the are we breeding complexity by having sort of mixed attributes? And I'm actually mixing some things up and framing that. But Larry, I think you might again as a preparer might have a particularly good take on that.
Yeah, I see that. I think that's the crux of my concern is the complexity. It's that we're in the middle of an evolution, you know, towards fair value, where I think fair value is very relevant, very important. But to have it introduced into the primary financial statements, you have some either industries, you know, some constituents fight very vehemently for the exceptions to, you know, to create exceptions to rules. That they believe that to match either they're doing something like the hedge exception, you know, or for good economic reason, but then they want the financials to somehow reflect, you know, what they believe should be the appropriate, you know, depiction of what they're doing from the business side. So you build in an exception, you know, to just all fair value and running to the P&L. So to have, you know, go back to my investment portfolio of debt securities that could be at historical cost and amortized cost, or another investment security that could be running through comprehensive income and another one through net income, you know, how and you know, the exception, you know, an exception that that some people don't really focus on, but the fair value or the trading portfolio and the fact that the FASB actually allowed you to put into your trading portfolio something that you really don't intend. You don't run a trading desk. You're just a commercial company, and you could just designate when you acquire it that it's a trading security. And then, you know, the unintended consequence that comes out of something like that, where now the FASB then decides to that the cash flows from the sale of that security should be in the operating section of your cash flow statement. And all of a sudden, you know, you have, just because of how something was classified, you have this unintended consequence of changing a major metric, something in your financials that should be indicative of what your ongoing operations are all about. And you, and to try to get your financials to be transparent, you have this additional exercise of calling out to investors, hey, wait a minute, my cash flow really is bolstered this period by the sale of a security that happened to be classified as a trading security. And accounting rules, I mean, accounting is, I've had it described to me, accounting is the language of business. And it's a very complex language. We've made it more and more complex. And our challenge, I was once admonished, make sure you don't lie with that language. But it's sometimes hard to get across the right point to the, you know, to the various audiences using the language that's been constructed. So I absolutely agree that fair value is relevant and more important in financial information, but I'm concerned that in the primary financial statements, we're at such a stage where it's just a complex environment. It's very difficult to get across those messages in one set of primary financial statements with the mixed model that we have now.
Larry, what you're talking about the investment example, I thought was particularly good, and what it caused me to remember is that even though the investments may be fair valued, the debits or credits could run through other comprehensive income, and they wouldn't actually run their cycle through your earnings and earnings per share. But any given quarter, any given year end, you could literally, legitimately, take those securities that have embedded gains, sell all of those, and maybe hang on to the ones that aren't in that status, and contribute to your earnings, although you would not have necessarily the quality of earnings you might like to have if they were generated through your core operations. And then it would suggest to me that the key is disclosure, the investor understanding what makes up the fact that you maybe met the street's expectations that quarter. And again, there's nothing wrong under GAAP of doing that, provided that I think that it's transparent. Alana, do audit committees understand these finer points? Do they get into appreciating how fair value can, on the one hand, give you a certain balance sheet answer and perhaps at another time give you a very sort of separate income statement answer as it cycles through the P&L?
I hesitate to say yes, and I'm sure as heck I'm not going to say no. but I can assure you that, in my experience, the audit committees are presented with these issues, and the issues are addressed within the committee, and we have to struggle to sometimes, and sometimes not, to understand the difference between management's point of view, because what Larry has just said definitely resonates with me as a member of an audit committee, but also you have to bear in mind that sometimes textual disclosure doesn't tell the whole story. I mean, if you can hide issues and facts in the numbers, you certainly can hide them in textual disclosure. And frequently, I think that increasing disclosure also increases the complexity of the periodic reports that we have to file. So, bottom line is, yes, it is of concern, but at the bottom line, I think that as an audit committee member, you'd be hard put to choose in most circumstances to focus and say, I only want to know what's the reliable figure as opposed to the relevant figure. Mind you, as an audit committee member, we have to make sure that management's financial reporting fairly presents the financial condition, and I don't know how you can do that unless you are focused on what is relevant, in addition to being reliable. From my perspective, it's not always an either-or situation, and hopefully more often than not, it's a mixture of the two. And so it's difficult, but who promised us a rose garden?
Okay. Thank you, Don. I'm going to turn to you next because you're on audit committees as well. And, in fact, rumor has it that you may, in fact, qualify to be a financial expert in that context. At least I would hope so. So I'd love to get any thoughts you have, and then maybe we'll let Pat have the final word.
Well, without speaking from the audit committee perspective, it just strikes me that if you have an opportunity to learn one piece of information, if Larry were to acquire something from me, I think the piece of information that he would like to know is what is the fair value of that thing, not what I paid for it. And when I think about the MEXT attribute model, we've created the MEXT attribute balance sheet and income statement so that we have an income statement that we put out to the world as if earnings always go in the northeast direction, smoothly, predictably, whereas the balance sheet, where you really have to deal with some fair value changes, absorbs all the bumps along the way. So there's a disconnect between those two statements. You can argue some would argue that's a good disconnect because it tells a story that they like to tell. Others would say we would all be better served knowing the facts, having really good, reliable information that comports with economics than we would be to, do somewhat make-believe accounting in one statement and reality based in another. And that's a model that I don't think is sustainable over a long period of time.
Could I just add one thing, because I did want to indicate that Larry's example of how you treat income from a trading security, was it? What was it?
Yeah, actually, what I was focused on was the cash flow classification of the proceeds of the sale of a trading security versus an available for sale.
Okay, that really resonated with me because it was an issue that was brought to the audit committee for a company that I serve. And we'll get into this later, but I think it does tee up how these decisions that management makes and the board accepts need to be left alone, perhaps unless it's definitely wrong, by regulators. Because I have experienced a situation in which the company was required to change its accounting because the item was viewed as being a misclassification and financial statements had to be restated, and we all know how we hate to do that, where there was absolutely no bottom line impact. So there was not one whit of difference to the bottom line. So we have to be thinking if, to the extent we move towards fair value, to the extent that we move towards more principle-based accounting, that we need to have a more open and flexible view when we're reviewing these the final results and be judicious in those that we take to task because you disagree that it could have been or should have been done a different way.
And we are going to get into that in just a minute. Pat, any final thoughts before we move on to our next topic?
I think Alana just raised a very good point that's often missed, in that for financial analysis, classification of an item in the balance sheet, in the income statement, in the cash flow statement, really, really, really matters because different weights are placed on them, and investors take different views depending on how an item is characterized. There's been in valuation a big shift away from when I started in this business 30 years ago, doing valuations based on multiples of earnings, and more towards what would be viewed as fair value type valuation models, enterprise value, EBITDA, discounted cash flow. And there's a movement, a movement away from focusing on reported GAAP earnings and a focus on either operating cash flow or free cash flow. And as that shift has occurred, what we've been noticing is that management hasn't missed that. I mean, investors shifted away from looking at earnings because they perceived that earnings was being managed. And so they started looking at operating cash flow and free cash flow because they thought it could be less managed. And hasn't been missed by management, and management has found ways to manage operating cash flow and free cash flow. But I don't think that addresses your question of relevance and reliability trade-off, but it is an interesting issue in the investment community now.
It is a great issue, but the point is that value is perceived by people who are experts in this, may not emanate from the financial statements, but other techniques that we all understand, discounted cash flows being among them, are really what people look to. So the question is, have the financial statements, at least for that purpose, lost the usefulness they may have once had when we were doing perhaps a little more naively multiple-based models and the like? But, you know, this really tees up our next sort of facet of this, and we've touched on it, but we've not really talked about it directly, and that is the standards complexity issue leads us all to step back and say, well, how do we ever get here? I've got some really very capable, and I mean top-notch client service partners who, in an honest day, will say, look, I'm pretty smart, and I am a CPA, but if I've got a client that has a complicated situation with derivatives, with securitizations, with 123R, with variable interest entities, and they've got all these matters present, it's very, very difficult today to feel that the company in the first instance is going to get their accounting right the first time, that as the auditor, an individual, a man or a woman who's responsible for signing the report, you can do that without a lot of experts and a lot of help because it just isn't possible. So we step back and say, how did things get so complicated? And there are lots of reasons for that, but the answer often is, well, these standards are so rules-based that on the one hand, you can circumvent them by making certain that the rules are dealt with one way or the other. And on the other hand, we've gotten away from what the basic idea, the basic principle is. So let's move from rules-based to principles-based standards. And it sounds so darn appealing because we all strive for simplicity. So the question really for the panel is, what are the challenges and impediments to achieving that? That's assuming you believe it's a good idea, moving from rules-based to principles-based. And secondly, and I think this is very relevant for the Commission, how is this going to change the way the Commission and staff work with registrants, work with their auditors? Because right now, there's pretty much oftentimes a bright line or a right answer. You get into principles-based standards, and there's a lot more judgment involved. So those may be completely different questions, but I think of them as related. And, Don, maybe I'll just kick it off for you to start and see what your views might be.
It is an enormous challenge to think about moving from where we are today. We didn't get to where we are today overnight. This took a lot of years. When I began in the profession, which was more than a few years ago, there was a very small amount of guidance that actually existed. You could fit it all very nicely into less than 50 pages. But it did cover all the major areas of financial reporting. Financial statements looked different back then, primarily in length of footnotes, not so much in terms of real content. What we have seen develop over a period of time is, I was reading Business Week on the way down here this morning. They had a very good article on Enron, or series of articles on Enron, a part of which is, if you want to boil it down to, one relatively short thought process, it was an intent to comply with the letter of the rules, but not the spirit of the rules. And I think that's really what's troubling the profession and has led to enormous amount of complexity. I've said this before, and those in the preparer community don't be offended by this, but one of the difficult jobs that the FASB has is to write an accounting standard that has acceptability within the preparer community, and usually it gets dragged out if it's a significant change. It gets dragged out so long that by the time the standard's actually introduced, it has very little impact on any company, any place. It has already been dealt with. It's already been corrected. It's already been adjusted for. Compensations have been made. Deals not unsavory deals, but deals made in the daylight are cut along the way to say, scope this out, provide this exception, do this kind of thing. And that does result in enormous complexity, and it makes it extremely difficult to say this is the overarching principle, but yet we have, you could say about derivatives and financial instruments that you could probably write the standard on a page or two, the basic principle. It's the other 800 pages that are necessary to tell you how not to comply with those basic rules. And that's where we've gotten ourselves into, to those who are comforted by having a rule. It's very hard to give that up to those who would think we could do that quickly. I would caution you, I don't think so. I think it took us a long time to get to where we are, and it'll take us a while to get away from a rules-based society to one where we basically can get back to basic principles, few exceptions to those principles, and enough guidance around implementation issues to make it workable. If you, the days where new products were one of the areas where companies would look at, well, we're introducing a new product. Does this product comply with all the rules? Well, what you find is that not all things that are new products necessarily get defined as new products and don't get subjected to those tests. And in a rules-based society, the rule is always written after the horse is out of the barn. It's already happened. Now we need to fix it, so we write a rule around it. And you would hope that we could get back to a point, and I'm not going to say that when I began in the profession that that we did things right. It was just different, and I think there was more of a thought process as to why you did what you did. I know I certainly wrestled with that. There's a long period ahead of us, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I haven't been in the profession quite as long as Don, but I kind of long for those days as well, where I grew up thinking, and I always thought of myself kind of more as the generalist. I did have one specialty, which fortunately was taken away from me when they did away with pooling of interest accounting. But in fact, I told the FASB board member once that faced with the prospect of having to learn a new specialized body of knowledge once they did away with poolings, I had the choice of either leaving the accounting public accounting profession or learning about derivatives, so I left public accounting and went to something simple like a cable company. Being a generalist and kind of like often people will say, like, I try to get at the when they're talking to me about an accounting issue, I try to kind of get at the root and think about, what is the transaction and what, and there's a sense, you come up with an account, a common sense, an accounting sense or whatever of what the right answer is. And unfortunately, after I go through that process, then my exercise is to search the massive body of written rules to find out if a rule has been written that says my accounting sense is wrong. Because there's an exception written about, I think I understood the principles, and that's part of the challenge now is that, we're dealing with a profession that isn't all of our same vintage, so that there are a lot of people that have actually never lived in a principles-based or grew up in a principles-based accounting world. All they've done is apply rules all their lives. And when I talk to some of those people, and I've had interesting debates about, one person once said to me, tried to refer to the principle underlying an EITF issue. And I pointed out that the EITFs were all rules. There are no principles whatsoever in EITF issues. At least they're not supposed to be. They're all supposed to be set by the FASB. It's going to take a really long time for us to get to principles. Because not only do you have to have principles-based standard setting, you then have to have principles-based application, and then you have to have principles-based regulation and or enforcement. I think about, you know, what was once buried in a staff accounting bulletin, and it was actually written in the context of encouraging registrants to come in and talk to the staff about complex or novel areas, because the consequences of a disagreement after the application of the accounting and the publication of your financial statements can often be severe. So it was encouraged that people come in and consult. But there used to be, an application where, you know, you'd come in and the staff, whether it was before or after the fact, and this is not really intended to be critical of the current staff, or, you know, it's just evolved to this where it seems like there ought to be two questions asked. A, did you get the accounting right? And if you didn't, the second question is, how bad was it? And it used to be that restatements were reserved for only the most egregious application and errors that were in financials. And it doesn't seem like that second question is asked frequently enough as to, you know, especially given how complicated everything is, that it's not always as, you know, if you got the rule wrong, you know, sometimes, you know, the staff would then, you know, and I was one of those staff that, you know, we'd have to go out and make a speech to tell people that, hey, we've came across this and we don't like this application and everybody's on notice. And, you know, if you were put on notice by one of those speeches and you had one of those transactions, sometimes you'd have to come in and talk to the staff about whether you, that's an ongoing transaction, whether you're going to change your accounting prospectively or retroactively. And, the whole benefit, I thought, to the PAF program, and I still think it is, that there's an interaction between the, you know, the accounting profession, the regulator, and there's a better appreciation of where everybody fits in the financial reporting model. We're going to need that again for us to be able to move to principles-based, you know, standards and application.
On the issue of principles versus rules-based, my observation would be that if you have principles-based standards, and I think that in most, if not all, standards that have been issued by the FASB, there is an underlying principle. Sometimes you have to dig pretty far to find it. But where they seem to go astray is when they put in exceptions and options. And if you're going to have principles-based standards, they can't have exceptions or options. And this goes back to your first issue. I don't think that you can have standards that don't have exceptions and options until we have one single measurement attribute. Otherwise, you've got gaming between standards. You've got mismatches in the income statement. So until we resolve what our measurement attribute is going to be, I don't think that you're going to avoid the exceptions and the options, and therefore you're going to have rules-based accounting, because you need rules to tell you when the exceptions and the options are appropriate.
Let me just respond to that quickly. I think that part of the issue is, where's that dividing line? If you're going to have a mixed attribute model, how do you clearly know what it is, and how do you know that it's comparable company to company? And I think that is an area that can be dealt with. I also think that there's opportunity with the degree of technology that exists today that didn't exist when I entered the profession to be able to provide lots of information. XBRL is a good way to think about, and there are other tools, too, to think about getting a lot of detailed information out that is very rules-based, very detailed, very specific, very comparable company to company. And if that is comprehensive enough and is working, then to move the financial statements, the summary of transactions, to something that is more principles-based with realization that you have an underlying rock-solid way to know, well, what's in those accounts and how are they valued, provides an opportunity for us to move forward and to maybe do that on a more accelerated basis than if we were to just think about principles-based only. I would say, the regulator, there is always going to be an element of tension between preparer, auditor, and regulator, and I think that's healthy. I think it would be a mistake to think that the regulators are your friend, that, you know, I did something wrong, and help me now not be hurt by that. You know, I think the reality is And I do think that the commission does do a pretty good job of trying to distinguish between those things that have great significance and are message important, and those things that are just bumps along the way. You know, accidents do happen.
Well, briefly, I agree with all of the above, which is why this is an issue on which I'm neutral. And those of you who know me know that I'm a person of strong opinion. And I'm neutral on this because I think this is a debate of that has become part of the human condition. And we don't know the answer yet, and I'm not sure, frankly, that we'll ever know the answer. As Don pointed out, when he was a young accountant, GAAP was principles-based, but over the years, I could put in a dig and say the centuries or the decades, but over years, people sought guidance, and they became more complex and complicated as guidance is issued, and now we have what is called something that's called rules-based. Well, who knows? I would commend to you keeping track of what is going on in the world outside of the United States with the adoption of the international accounting standards. And perhaps they do tout themselves, the IASB touts itself as having presented the world with a principles-based set of accounting principles. And from what I'm reading in the foreign press, because now everybody in the EU has to adopt them, and it's they're in an uproar. They've really got their knickers in a twist over there, because nobody knows what they're supposed to do with these principles-based standards and what the financial statements really are communicating once they have been applied. So, as I say, I'm neutral, and if you want a referee, I'll give you my number.
Wow, well, I've never known you to be neutral, but I guess there's a first for everything. Well, I have a couple of thoughts on principles-based standards, and then I think we have time for one more good discussion in the time we have left for the program, and I want to get to I'll call it the bigger question. I think the real challenge with principles-based standards, because it's very hard to find anybody who thinks that's a bad idea. But it's the change in behavior and what some would term the gamesmanship around applying the standards we have today. And that Larry's point is excellent. Entire generation of young people in the auditing profession that have grown up only with rules. Preparers that might have some very specific goals for reasons that are decent business reasons to have a transaction come out a certain way. And the discussions, of course, are going to be not a client telling me as an auditor, show me in the book where it says I can't do that, but the discussion should be, does this transaction, does this accounting comport with the principle that's set forth in the standard that governs this area of accounting? And to be able to have a legitimate debate, sometimes with differences in judgment, same debate with the regulators, feels like it's a very different world than a lot of us have been living in, but for one, I'm kind of ready to get off the merry-go-round anyway and do something that makes a little more common sense. And sometimes it would come down to the amount of respect, if you will, the relationships between auditor-client, auditor-regulator, client-regulator, to see something in a way that might result in more than one right answer. I remember when I was on the staff, Clarence Sampson, we would have registrants come in and do a pre-filing, and there were times when he said, that, you know, they have support for their position. I don't particularly like it, but I don't have a basis to tell them no. And after Howard Hodges stormed out of the room, we generally, you know, got through the issue. But, I mean, that was his orientation was there may be more than one right answer. And what it's really all about at that time and for him as chief accountant of the moment, of the year, you know, this has to feel right to me. This has to make sense. There has to be substantial authoritative support. And even though I don't agree, I'm not going to say no because I respect their process. I respect the way they've pulled this together. And, you know, on we go to the next one. But I think all of this causes me to ask even a more pressing question, perhaps, or maybe a broader question. You know, whether we're talking about complexity, whether we're talking about the number of restatements, whether we're talking about principles versus rules, we're still talking about a set of historical audited financial statements, the three primary statements, the balance sheet, the income statement, the cash flow statement, the related disclosures, the MD&A, the whole package. The real question in my mind is, have we reached a point in the development of financial reporting where maybe some might suggest that this isn't meeting the needs of investors, this really isn't working? And perhaps Pat is right, we first need a single measurement attribute. Perhaps others are right, if we just take what we have and focus on one area and keep evolving it, no problem. Others might say, well, what about operating measures? What about non-GAAP measures, which has been a huge issue with the Commission, first sort of, you know, banning them in many ways, and then figuring out a common sense way to allow investors to get those measures, provided that management can justify their usefulness. Where are we going, and where should we go on the whole financial reporting model? And have we reached a point in our history, just the development of the world, I guess, that we should be taking a fresh look, stem to stern, however you want to say it? I'd love to get the panel's views.
As I alluded to earlier, the Chartered Financial Analyst Institute has put out a paper that is trying to look forward and say the statements that we have now aren't as useful as they might be for investors and what might be a way forward. And it has proposed a new set of financial statements in this report. And as I mentioned earlier, there really isn't an income statement in this new set of statements. There is a statement of changes in net assets available to existing common shareholders. So it includes all transactions that would affect existing shareholders' equity in this statement. So it's not really your traditional income statement. And it's lined up in columns, and it's also got a different sort of breakdown on the left side. There's another statement that is intended to reconcile the beginning and ending balance sheet numbers to help investors understand what are cash flows, what are revaluations, what are remeasurements, what are changes in estimates. It's a unique set of statements, and I think it would be worthwhile for people who are interested in evolving the current financial reporting model to take a look at it. I think it has the advantage that it could be applied and should be applied to the existing mixed attribute model, and as you move more and more towards the fair value model, a lot of the columns in the thing collapse.
While Larry looks for his button, I think the time is here. It is time for us to move forward with some innovative thinking into how to do things better. I do think the investor suffers both from a combination of overload of repetitive information. It's not too hard to look through a set of financial statements, SEC filings that have MD&A and the president's letter and then the financial statements all repeating essentially the same things without really adding a whole lot of light to it, just a lot of verbiage, and it does leave you with the impression that this is not a communication but from management to investors in a real sense. It's more compliance with a lot of rules that are out there and a tendency to say, if it worked last time, don't fool around with it. We're going to repeat that same process. And when you look at that, and that's an incrementalism approach that we have, and a lot of standard setting is that. You find something went wrong, so you write a rule or a new accounting standard that says, either account for it this way or disclose additional disclosure. I think we have to find something that's deeper in an organization than that. And I think technology has to be part of that. If we can't do it better, faster, cheaper, I think doing more and more and more incrementally, costly, add on this, look at it this way, that kind of thing, over time will make all of us so tired of a compliance-based model that it'll be very, very difficult for an investor to really understand what's within the company that they're intending to invest in or to compare it with another company.
Both Don and Pat have stated that the time has come to take a fresh look at the financial reporting model, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. The FASB and others have been talking about doing that for at least 5 or 6 years. I do not consider myself qualified to speak to what that new model might look like, but what Pat described is very interesting. I suspect that that we might be better off with a revolutionary change rather than an evolutionary change, because otherwise you just never get there. You get financial statements, and believe me, as a member of a couple of boards of directors, I've seen over the past 10 years or 7 years, the financial statements grow from 12 to 15 pages to 50 pages because of additional disclosures. And most of these disclosures are textual disclosures to explain the numbers in the income statement and the balance sheet, et cetera. So the time is ripe, and with, it seems to me, XBRL, if I've got the anagram right, Don is right. Technology should provide us a tool to change the format. And while I know very little about this new technology, I do know it's out there, and I do know that corporate America is trying to deal with it, some more quickly than others. Perhaps it is the future, and perhaps the SEC should be, or the PCOB, should be really organizing a task force or assigning to the staff to figure out the potential for this particular technology, this tool, so that we can require people, because you're going to require them to have the technology. Maybe that's the right, this is the time to require them to reformat financial statements as well.
Yeah, I guess a couple of things. One is that, you know, we talk about the financial reporting model, but as the letters actually indicate, it's XBRL is business reporting, which might be a little bit broader. And I think about some of the things that are in our earnings press release that people are interested in that are not in the primary financial statements. And the challenge here really is that I think you're absolutely onto it, Don, that the business reporting, if you can get technology to handle some of the data, that the data elements that some people are interested in, that clearly are being, they're attempted to being communicated through financial reporting, they are linked together. If you can allow data access through XBRL to, for example, our number of, you know, like, you know, which of our securities, which I was focused on, I go back to my investment portfolio, you don't have to classify or tell people which of your securities are classified as, you know, trading. And, you know, we make a point of trying to do that so people can understand why our income statement fluctuates the way it does. If you could just data tag all of your securities so that people can go into your footnote and figure out, and if they want to run a model that figures out, you know, that will be very powerful in terms of expanding people's understanding of financial statements. So if you think of this broader as more broadly than financial reporting and go into business reporting, that my disadvantage was coming in as an accountant into my company, not as a business person growing up in the company. One of the things I did was reach over to, which Investor Relations doesn't report to me, but I needed to understand what their job was and who they spoke to and what their needs were, and a lot of their needs are not met through the financial statements. and that's the part that we have to try to pull together.
Let me observe something, I'll just declare that although I'm not neutral, I agree with everybody. I mean, Pat's points are excellent. Don certainly has been dealing with this issue both in his prior role and continues to show leadership in that area. I agree with Larry. XBRL is a wonderful tool, but I'm thinking that this might be, you know, a huge deal, not just a big deal. In other words, is this a task force? Is this a presidential commission? Is this, I hasten to say this is not a congressional issue. I think it's an issue, though, that would have to bring together the private sector, the existing regulators, in very much a leadership role. But even if you do that and you come up with a model or a series of recommendations that might take a while or a very long time to implement, we're living in a global environment, and you know, we've got an international standard setter. You know, can we even think about legitimately doing this within our borders, or would this whole effort need to be global in focus? And if that's true, you know, can we ever get it done? We only have a couple minutes, but it take maybe a 30 seconds or, you know, I'll start with Pat, but to me, that's the sort of the bigger ultimate issue.
Well, certainly, I believe that if you're going to redo the basic financial statements, that definitely has to be done on a global basis, because you need at least a common starting ground so you have comparability. As far as XBRL goes, I think it has a great deal of potential. I think there are... my sense is that there are two types of preparers out there. Preparers that are scared to death that it will result in them reporting things that they don't report today, and those that are hoping that it will allow them to report things that they don't report today. XBRL is being developed on a global basis. The international financial reporting standards are already tagged to go into XBRL. So if you're filing statements under IFRS, I'm told that it's easy. I can't believe it's actually easy, but they say it's easy to do your statements in XBRL, to provide XBRL format. But it has, in today's global environment, all of this stuff needs to be developed on a global basis.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the global aspect. Just the part of that does cause me some concern is that it's also very easy to then get caught up in diplomacy and the politics of whose system and how do you do this. And I think we're at the point where there probably is enough good direction already started that if we could really build on that in the private sector, and I really think it's important that the private sector take the lead here, whether it's domestically or globally. And if you produce a better product, that better product ought to be able to sell itself. And the thing that, again, I'll say the three things that I would look to, it has to be better, it has to be cheaper, and it has to be a whole lot faster than what we have today.
I don't think that you really bring about change through consensus necessarily, at least not very quickly. So I would say that everybody should be working on this, and as Pat has pointed out, it's already sort of being formulated in the international arena, and there's nothing wrong with us taking the lead and trying to do something new. And as Don says, if we churn up a good product, we meaning the accounting profession here in the United States turns out a good product, it should be relatively easy to sell and become global eventually. Hopefully faster than standards now converge.
I agree.
Oh, Larry, I'm glad this is being webcast, because two-word answer from Larry Salvo. I appreciate that. Let's close down our panel, and I'd ask you to join me in giving them a big thank you for all their insights. We're actually going to stay put for the last segment of our program, and that is to hear from Scott Taub, the SEC's acting chief accountant, for his views on some of the things we've touched on today. Scott?
Bob, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. As most of you know, I do a whole lot of speaking to get the word out about what's happening in the Office of the Chief Accountant. Amongst all those speeches and presentations, I've had some pretty daunting time slots. I've spoken at a 7 a.m. session after a late-night reception. I've done a training session on a Saturday morning. I was the last speaker at a conference that ended on Saturday afternoon. And once I had to follow Paul Volcker. Not only was he a better speaker with far more interesting things to discuss, but he's about 6'9", so when I got to the podium, I had to reach up to get the microphone. Of course, I've been the last speaker before lunch or drinks time and time again. But none of those slots was as challenging as this one, because today I stand between a bunch of SEC staff members and free ice cream. So I promise I'll keep this brief. Of course, I do need to remind you that I speak only for myself today and not for the commission or my colleagues on the SEC staff. Now, you've just heard a distinguished panel discuss many of the key issues facing the financial reporting world. Normally, I'd now tell you what the SEC is doing in regards to those issues. But given the audience, many of you already know about those efforts. So instead, I'm going to spend the next few minutes on several key issues about the framework under which we at the SEC and other participants in the financial reporting process think about the issues. The right mindset in these areas will help ensure that reporting in the future will serve the capital markets as it should and will allow us to more easily drive down errors and the costs of reporting while making things more understandable for investors, or as Don said, cheaper, better, faster. In keeping with the fact that we're at a meeting of the SEC Historical Society, I'm going to start with a quote from one of my predecessors, Mike Sutton, regarding the objective of financial reporting. Quote, "Public policy objectives should not supplant or compromise the essential goal of financial reporting to public investors, providing reliable, decision-useful information to shareholders and prospective shareholders. Accounting and disclosure should have no other public policy objectives than to provide the best possible financial reporting to investors that will serve as a sound basis for investment decisions. To accomplish those objectives, financial reporting must portray economic transactions and events and economic performance in a neutral way, without slanting the results to favor any one economic interest," unquote. Unfortunately, many standards today include compromises that are intended to allow the reporting of economic events to be deferred, or that simply allow certain things to not be reported at all, in the interests of encouraging, or at least not discouraging, certain business transactions. Currently, these discussions generally go to accounting for pensions and leases. In the past, it was derivatives or stock options. I've sometimes spoken pretty candidly on this subject, and I've been rebuked for it by policymakers, senior officers of companies, and even my best friend, who happens to be controller for a dot-com company. So instead of sticking my neck out again, I'll reinforce the message by looking to Chief Accountant Sandy Burton, who said in 1973, quote, "If on the basis of realistic economic data, investors would require a greater return on capital, it is not desirable to coax them into an investment on the basis of defective measurements. I have heard from others the argument that showing the truth would cause higher costs or what have you. I don't believe this is adequate justification, either morally or economically, for falsehood in financial statements," unquote. My point, to ensure vibrant markets, we need to make sure that investors get standards that choose transparency over predictability, relevance of information over precision of calculation, and the needs of investors over those of management, regulators, and others. Now, to help me make my next point, I'll turn once again to one of my predecessors, Chief Accountant Clarence Sampson, who you've heard mentioned here today already. In 1985, Clarence said, quote, "Fair presentation is hard to define, but you know it when you see it. It is not fair to account for a transaction in a manner which presents it in the best light for the company regardless of the realities, and it is not fair for a company to structure transactions to report desirable results, thereby artificially disguising its real results," unquote. The FASB writes standards that are intended to be applied by people who are trying to accurately report the results of transactions. The exact opposite of that is entering into a transaction that's intended at the outset to result in reporting that's inconsistent with the economics of that transaction. Now, sometimes when I talk about the evils of transaction structuring, those I speak to raise the concern that it's difficult to identify accounting-motivated transactions. But I don't think that's the case at all. Like Clarence said, you do know it when you see it. And I believe that a good, knowledgeable accounting professional knows when he or she is abusing the literature instead of applying it in the manner in which it was intended. And it's those abusive situations that ought to be ended. Now, I'll again look to the past to help me envision the future of financial reporting as I plagiarize comments of Chief Accountant Andrew Barr back in 1963. He said, quote, "Accounting is not an exact science. Precise rules or mathematical formulas cannot be devised as guiding principles. Accounting decisions are largely a matter of judgments," unquote. Now, unfortunately, we've gotten to a place today where there is something of an aversion to applying judgment. Often the answer people seek is whichever one is perceived to be safest, but those answers are not always the most transparent for investors. And we constantly get calls for every potential interpretive matter to be documented and the answer officially blessed. This, of course, leads us further into complexity and rules-based standards, which is a place where we all say we don't want to go. The SEC staff has, of course, written at length about this in our 2003 report on objectives-oriented accounting standards. As that report noted, successfully implementing principles-based standards will necessitate an even greater reliance on professional judgment. This will be difficult if practitioners continue to be reluctant, afraid, or unable to make well-reasoned professional judgments. Some of the factors that have gotten us to this point are clear. Fears of litigation continue to rise. Scrutiny of accounting and auditing is, of course, as high as it's ever been. And it's not surprising that in this environment, people feel like they're exposed if they rely on their own judgment to make important reporting decisions. In addition, many have blamed the SEC in large part for this state of affairs, suggesting that our actions raise the fear of being second-guessed to the point where people just aren't willing to leave open that possibility. I continue to try to do something about that. We obviously shouldn't be objecting to well-founded, reasonable judgments that are made within the context of the existing literature. Keeping to the pattern of this speech, I tried to find words from a former chief accountant to help me here, and I did find this comment on the subject of judgment from Walter Schutz in 1993. Quote, "Some people say that financial statement preparation ought to be left in large part to the judgment of those who prepare and audit financial statements, that we should have broad general financial accounting reporting standards emanating from the FASB, with their implementation being left to the issuer of financial statements and its auditor. That approach will not work. Broad general rules left to the judgment of issuers and their auditors have not worked and will not work," unquote. Okay, so maybe chief accountants over the years haven't always sent consistent messages here. I do believe, though, that what Walter was really complaining about were biased and unprincipled judgments that are improperly described as applying judgment in accounting. And, of course, we ought to object to that when we see it. In the same 1963 speech that I referred to before, Andrew Barr, when reading from a previous publication, explained this quite well. Quote, "The acceptability of judgment and estimate in accounting does not extend to willful or wishful expedience. The estimates and judgments must have a rational basis under the circumstances. That is, a justification stronger than self-seeking arbitrary choice and stronger than a desire to have accounting figures show what one wishes them to show," unquote. In the end, while bright lines need to be respected when they exist in GAAP, there are plenty of places where the accounting literature calls for the application of judgment. Preparers and auditors need to be professionals and make the necessary adjustments to ensure high-quality reporting. And so long as those judgments result in transparent reporting, they're unlikely to raise concerns that would cause us to need to object to them. I'll quote Clarence Sampson one more time to make my last point. Clarence noted, quote, "Management knows more about the company than investors or creditors and can often increase the usefulness of financial statements by identifying certain events and circumstances and explaining their financial effect on the company," unquote. Now, I've got a slide that I use when I do presentations that urges companies to go beyond the minimum requirements if that's what's needed to better communicate with investors. And a recommendation along these lines is included in the SEC staff report on off-balance sheet arrangements that was released last year. Too often, though, the attitude seems to be that if a disclosure isn't explicitly required, then there's no reason to make it. I actually heard an executive of a company suggest that there wasn't a disclosure violation in regards to backdating of stock options because the current executive compensation rules don't specifically require disclosures about backdating. And I constantly hear people cite the fact that key performance indicators aren't in SEC reports as evidence of a deficiency in the standards or rules. This is despite the fact that there's nothing to stop companies from disclosing those key performance indicators voluntarily, but not many of them choose to do it. Let's face it, there is no way the SEC and the FASB can write standards and rules that comprehensively list all of the disclosures that might be important to investors. Indeed, attempts to do that are likely to contribute to confusion, even more complexity, and disclosure overload. We'll be much better off if instead of disclosing only what is specifically required, companies disclose the key information, whether there is a specific requirement related to that piece of information or not. If this happens, quality of disclosure will improve without any new regulatory burdens. In conclusion, let me say that I hope you've enjoyed spending these few minutes exploring the financial reporting issues of today with me, with the members of this panel, and with the others whose words that I've used so liberally in putting together these remarks. There's a lot to do as we move forward, but the Historical Society reminds us, and the preparation of these remarks has reminded me in particular, that we can often learn a lot about the issues of today by looking to the past. Thank you very much for your attention.
Scott, thank you very much. I appreciate your remarks, and I think they fit very well with the discussion that we had here on the panel. And I'd like to thank our panel once again for all their contributions. I'll remind you that all of these Scott's remarks and our panel discussion are now part of our permanent collection in our virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The audio version can be accessed at any time, and a transcript will be posted. I think our website also is being made to be, if it's not already, MP3 compatible. So I expect to see you all in the Metro using podcasts of our remarks today. I'll also point out that Scott very appropriately quoted many of the former chief accountants, and starting with Carmen Blau in 1935 and through many more recent chief accountants, including many of the quoted gentlemen today, we have their oral histories, again, in our museum and archive, and I think it would be great for you to, if you're interested in these topics, to take a listen. Our new president, John Ramsey, noted earlier that today does mark the 72nd anniversary, or birthday, if you will, of the SEC since its founding in 1934, and now it's time to recognize and celebrate that. I invite you all to the foyer outside the auditorium for our ice cream social, and while you're there, right in the middle, take a look at the bust of James Landis, who was one of the principal authors of the original securities laws in the 1930s, who was also the second chairman of the SEC after Joe Kennedy. That bust is on long-term loan to the SEC from the society. Thank you again for being with us today at our 7th annual meeting, and we look forward to your participation next year. Good afternoon.
This is very, very